A podcast of the cinema.
Why don't you tell people what we are?
We're a podcast of the cinema. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. You are Dave White.
Yes.
See, our identities are overlapping. We both write for The Wrap, and I do other podcasts, yes, such as Maximum Film and Breakfast All Day,
yes,
and every so often Deck the Hallmark.
Yes.
And you and I are married to each other, and we're both film critics, and isn't that fascinating? Yes, it is. We did a podcast.
You need to understand something.
What's that?
And I'm going to help you understand it.
Okay.
What I'm going to do is set up a very loud system of alarm bells.
Great.
That ring every 2 hours on the dot.
Mm-hmm.
Reminding you to get out of my way while I get my snack.
Yeah, I know. The snacks are important.
Here are the things you miss when you're not listening to the mic check or the conversations before the mic check.
Yes, and why don't you?
If only you would just come over, listener.
Sit at the kitchen table.
And hear these things. Someone in this house needs to understand how important it is for me to have my 4 p.m. snack after I take my afternoon blood sugar test.
I understand.
This is extremely important because if my blood sugar is low enough in the nice range, then I don't have to worry about what the snack is necessarily. I mean, it's not going to be a Twinkie, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a stalk of celery.
Right.
It could be two stalks of celery.
Ooh, crazy you know, town.
Live it up. I could dip those stalks of celery in some kind of dip. Who knows? Anything can happen.
I was not
just
trying to
get the food into my mouth after I take my blood sugar test.
I was not trying to get into the way of your snack in any way. I was only concerned about how that snack might interfere with the impending recording of this podcast. And I think those are legitimate concerns.
I'll eat on the mic. Listen.
No, you will not.
If you want to.
You did that once. We lost listeners. Never again.
You know what? We need to be absolved of that because it was
10 years
nine
ago.
And a half years ago when that happened.
Well, it was a valuable lesson that we never.
And if you're new to this podcast, that's how long we've been doing this podcast.
We're coming up on our 11th anniversary.
That's correct. And our 26th anniversary.
Yeah.
This Friday,
mm-hmm,
October 1st. How do you like it so far? How do you like your first 26 years with me?
They've been pretty good.
They've been fine.
Fine. Oh, fine.
Better than the film The Space Between Us.
Well, most things are. That's a low bar. That bar is on the floor.
A.K.A. Candy Bones.
Yes.
They called him Candy Bones.
A movie that no one remembers but us because we constantly mock it.
Deserved it.
It also gave us that great moment of Britt Marling. No.
Britt Robertson.
Britt Robertson, yeah. Thank you. Sorry. One of the Brits. Why does everybody always have to be fronting?
She did not write the script.
I know.
That poor girl.
We know who wrote that. Alan Loeb wrote that line for her.
Bless him.
Yes.
God bless him. It's Monday afternoon. The embargo for the movie, the documentary, The Jesus Music, lifted today.
Yes.
And my review posted.
It's at The Wrap. You should go read it.
This film does not open for another 4.5-ish days.
Right.
We won't even be talking about it for another 5.5-6 days.
On this show.
We might even have a special guest.
Mm-hmm.
We hope we have a special guest.
That's the plan.
They said yes.
Yes.
You know, anything can happen, though.
Of course. We will be talking about it Friday on KCRW.
We'll be talking about it on Friday on KCRW, but what I'm trying to get at right now is that I've already got people explaining things to me on Twitter.
Oh, good. Those are the best.
And I'm weighing my options. So far, nobody has come at me in a bad way. But you know what I really hate having on Twitter? Is any conversations. I don't like it.
You can ignore, you can mute, you can block.
People are starting to follow me again.
You can do all kinds of things.
Listen, you know I don't like having new followers.
I know, that's such a hardship for you.
I don't like it very much.
Micro-influencer that you are.
If I get too many, I'll just start posting, like, communist things or pictures that friends post on their alts.
Maybe not that. But you can go homosexual without having to go naked.
If you have an alt and you want me to repost your complete full frontal nudity.
There are people.
It might really help me.
People who have been following you for a long time maybe don't necessarily want to see that. But they're not the people that you're mad at.
I'm very good about. Listen, I have a lot of friends. You know how the gays are.
I do. Do
the gays love to get naked. I have friends who have alts on Twitter.
Sure, we all do.
And I never, I make a point every once in a while of saying, hey, you know, thanks for the alt.
Thumbs up.
You're doing good work here.
Three cheers for nudity.
Yeah, but I never click like on anything.
Well, no.
And because that'll show up on my feed, and all these people who didn't ask for it are like, hey
what?
Whose butt is that?
Yeah, there is a publicist of a certain age who has no such filter for that sort of thing. And so I'll something will pop up my feed. I'm like, whoa, oh, he liked it.
Okay. He clicked like. That's what you got to watch who you click like on. See, I only click like on other incendiary tweets.
Yes. Inflammatory content that is not of the naked
variety. I'm trying to get right-wing people out of my feed by posting, you know, this or that from whoever.
Yeah, that's
Jacobin,
piece of cake. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard, Dave, they're real snowflakes.
I'm a real snowflake.
You're a little teapot.
What I am is a hostess snowball.
Mm. Oh, God, are we talking about the Starling yet, or is that later? There's a recurring hostess snowball metaphor in that movie. One of many metaphors.
Listen, I
in
didn't
that
watch
movie.
The Starling. You were in the living room watching the Starling. I was doing housework.
Yes.
And I did see the hostess snowballs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is actually the one shot in the movie that I stood and looked at the TV screen for a few minutes, because the entire scene revolved around a grocery store's end cap display.
Yes.
Of hostess snowballs. But it was the kind of, like, circular pyramid of food that you actually never see in a grocery store
outside
of movies. And you certainly don't see them, you know, that beautiful.
Yeah.
And that, like, colorful and vibrant.
Well, and not in the individual serve packaging either.
No,
it would
be like boxes of them if they were going to do it at all.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of the giant pyramid of cans in a Jerry Lewis movie that's just waiting for some cart to come slamming into it.
Yeah, grocery stores way back in the day, like when we were children and before, used to do this kind of thing. And it was always, honestly, being a child in a grocery store when they used to do those kinds of displays, like going to Disneyland. Like, oh, look, it's a pyramid. It's a tunnel of mayonnaise. Like, why can't this be every day in my life?
I think that was the supermarket flex. It's like, well, you could go to your dusty neighborhood market where they have four jars of mayonnaise.
Right.
We have enough to make a ziggurat out of.
So, here's the other thing that's unusual about that moment in The Starling, which is a film starring Melissa McCarthy and Chris O'Dowd.
Yes. And Kevin Klein.
And Kevin Klein, which I did not watch, so Alonzo's going to be the one talking about it, but not until after we finish this discussion of Hostess Snowballs.
Snowballs, for sure.
I can't tell you the last time I saw a blue one. I see the pink ones.
Yeah.
You know?
In the wild. I don't know that I've ever seen a blue one, frankly.
There's a big display of blue ones.
I've never eaten one. I don't think.
Any kind of Hostess Snowball?
I don't think I've ever eaten a Hostess Snowball.
Not even a pink one?
I don't think so.
How can this be?
Because if I have a choice of Hostess products, I'm going to go towards the Ding Dong or...
I'm going to tell you something. You need to have a Hostess Snowball.
Okay.
Because they're big, spongy, coconutty, marshmallowy, what delicious are the, what,
do
treats.
Do the pink ones have like a strawberry fake flavor?
Yeah. I will enjoy... watching you eat one. I will not be eating one because of my malady.
Yes.
But the
eat one and then do your blood sugar test and let's watch it explode.
But like,
I think the monitor immediately calls 911 for you.
I was saying, like, you know, the class I'm in right now, the Saturday morning type 2 class, the scale of your ACE A1C,
uh-huh,
and it goes up to like 12, but apparently it goes higher than 12 because someone in the class was like, yeah, when I got diagnosed, it was 13. I was like, how are you alive right now?
Yikes.
And so I'm learning new things every day. But
so do the pink snowballs have like a fake strawberry flavor?
There's like, it's like chocolate inside.
Okay.
The pink is just a color.
Okay, so the blue ones would also just be chocolatey. Okay.
Yeah.
Ostensibly.
But I'm telling you.
And next time I see any color
my mouth is watering.
In the wild, I will pick it up and bring it home and eat it in front of you for your delectation.
Yeah, I would love that.
Okay.
Maybe we can have some delivered to the house, since we're not actually going to grocery stores right now.
Always a possibility.
It's true.
But don't get like a box of them, because I don't want to have that many around either.
Well, if we got a box, who's knocking on our door? Is someone knocking on our door?
It's a delivery, probably. Right. I don't know.
If we get a box of them, we can put one on a plate every time a friend comes over to sit on the balcony.
Great. So instead of a delicious homemade treat like from you that they used to get, they're like,
they're still going to get that, but okay. You know.
All right.
But why not sometimes a Hostess Snowball?
We can share the Hostess Snowball. Sure. Why not?
The Starling.
Yes.
Tell me what it's about first, and then tell me why it's not good.
Okay.
Because that I know that you don't like it.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Okay. Melissa McCarthy and Chris O'Dowd are a married couple. The film opens. We see them painting the room of their newborn daughter while the daughter is asleep in the crib. They are happy. We jump ahead. They are not happy.
Right.
The daughter has died of sudden infant death syndrome.
Right.
It has thrown them both for a loop.
Understandably.
Of course. O'Dowd's character is, in fact, in a private mental health facility. An hour away from where they live, she drives to see him once a week. Still has her job at the grocery store. Is trying to maintain some semblance of regular life, although obviously they're both dealing with a lot. She tries to get their garden back in order. But as she starts, you know, clearing out scrubs and whatnot, this starling keeps attacking her, like flying down and thwacking her in the head.
Yeah.
And she and Chris O'Dowd are clearly at something of an impasse. And so his therapist recommends to her that she also begin therapy and gives her the name and number of Kevin Klein's character, who had been a prestigious therapist for quite some time, but when Melissa McCarthy tracks him down, he is now working as a veterinarian. But he winds up sort of taking her on as a patient anyway, yada-da. This is a movie about people coming back from tragedy, but it is has nothing interesting to say about the people or the tragedy or how they deal with it. Everything is super on the nose, and like it's the kind of thing where the first time she sits and has a serious conversation with Kevin Klein, he immediately like pings every single thing that is wrong with her and what her defense mechanisms are and why she's not dealing with this and da da da. Like immediately, off, just, you know, out the gate running.
Okay.
There are,
but like, that's helpful though, right? If a doctor can say, "Well, here's your problem," right away.
Well, yeah, but yeah. Sure, but that's not how therapy or anything else works.
Oh, I suppose you're right.
And then you've got this movie. Like I said, the host of snowballs are a metaphor. The garden.
Wait. For what?
There's a flashback where Chris O'Dowd talks about how
this is a movie about grief. I shouldn't be laughing, but
well, yeah. It's not a good movie about grief. So okay. Knock yourself out. Chris O'Dowd talks about how his mother would put Host of Snowballs in his lunch box every day, and how apparently the old jingle was something like "Hostess means I love you" or something like that.
It really does.
And so that's,
I don't know if that was the,
that's what the,
not,
the metaphor but... is that she bring, every time she goes to visit him, she brings him a lunch sack with a Hostess snowball in it because,
all right,
I love you, you know. The garden is a metaphor. The starling is a metaphor. Everything's a freaking metaphor in this movie.
Right.
And none of it feels genuine or deeply felt or earned or any of that stuff. This was a Blacklist script.
Okay.
And I don't know much about The Blacklist, except that every time I review a movie that is made from a Blacklist script, more often than not, it's not great. So I don't know why, if these things read better than they shoot or what, but, you know, incredible waste of talent here. Not just McCarthy, O'Dowd, and Kevin Kline, but like David Diggs is in it, barely, for two scenes. Skylar Gisondo is in it.
Right.
Couple other, like, you know, people working way below their pay grades in this movie. Yeah. It's just kind of pointless, and it's a major letdown. It's from Theodore Melfi, who directed Hidden Figures, which I liked, and Saint Vincent, which I very much did not.
Okay.
It's treacly and it's nothing.
Treacly. Let's see. Treacle. Actual real life.
Actually, no, I know you like it.
It's nice.
Yes,
it's delicious.
I don't mean to demean treacle by comparing this movie to it. Let's say saccharin. Then, how about that?
So, so this is not a recommendation.
Very much not.
All right,
the opposite, in fact.
Well, thank you for saving me time.
You're welcome.
We have an ad to do.
We do, from our dear friends at Ovid.tv.
Do you like movies that no one else has ever seen or heard of? Yes, you do. That's why you're listening to this podcast.
That's right.
And so you need Ovid.tv in your home.
They have, every month, you know, a cavalcade of extraordinary international, independent documentary short films, the whole nine yards, and they're always adding to their very extensive online menu of streaming titles, and October 2021 is no exception. They have two of the many films they have coming up. They have two they've asked us to spotlight. One of them is Le Navire en Night, directed by the great Marguerite Duras. It is a film that Duras narrates with Benoît Jacquot. It stars Dominique Sanda, Mathieu Carrière, and Boule Ogier. Sanda and Carrière are lovers who never actually meet in person over the film. They communicate over the phone using unlisted numbers left over from the French Resistance. As it's described, elliptical sequences play out in empty streets, nocturnal cityscapes, and shadowy interiors, linked together only by the spectral presence of the characters' voices. If you only know Marguerite Duras as an art film joke in John Waters' Polyester, she is in fact an important and challenging French filmmaker, and John Waters would be the first to tell you that. And so her stuff doesn't turn up a lot. Like, you can't just hop onto, say, Netflix and watch The Truck.
Right.
You know, but Ovid.tv is going to have Le Navire Night available in October, and also in October.
You lucky, lucky people.
Yes.
A film, I'm going to tell you right now, I have not seen this movie that I'm about to tell you about, but just reading about it before we did the show has spun my head upside down and inside out, and now I have to watch it. It's called the Chuche idea. It's from it's an experimental feature from Jim Finn.
And that's spelled J-U-C-H-E.
Yeah. It is a Korean word. It translates roughly to self-reliance. It is a hybrid of Confucian and authoritarian Stalinist socialism. So there's a word for that.
Of course.
And I'll start at the beginning. In the 70s, a South Korean filmmaker was kidnapped to make propaganda films for North Korea. And this was because Kim Jong-il was really into movies, and he wanted to apply this Chuche philosophy to propaganda film. Now, Jim Finn's film is a film about that.
Right.
And so it is kind of a documentary, apparently, and it's also a musical.
Oh, I'm in.
And I'm it's like when someone wearing something very sparkly walks past you and you want to follow them. That's how I feel about just reading about this movie. So that's on my watch list for this week. And if you get Ovid.tv, it can be on yours as well.
So those are just two of the many films that are coming your way in October, in addition to all the films you can already find on the service. And because you are a listener to Linoleum Knife, use the code CINEMA when you sign up for a subscription and get a free month of Ovid.tv. That is, it's their name, it's their website, Ovid.tv.
Dear Alonzo Duralde, today is going to be a day where I break your arm. And then I'm going to sign someone else's name on your cast. And then I'm going to send you off to go watch Dear Evan Hansen three times in a row.
No!
At the local cinema.
Oh, you know that it screened on some IMAX screens.
Well, I don't want to think about that.
Can you even imagine?
I can only imagine.
Oh, no. I see what you did there.
All right. We're going to talk about the film Dear Evan Hansen, directed by Stephen Chbosky.
We did not see this on stage.
We did not.
But boy, did we see the movie.
But I have seen a photo of
Ben Platt
as Evan Hansen on stage on Broadway.
Yes.
And his hair is very different.
Yes.
And I have some questions. Before we start talking about the movie at all, I have some questions about the hair. Because I think the hair has a greater role to play in how people are taking this movie than perhaps you might imagine.
It is part of the unsettling process by which they are trying to make him look more like a 16-year-old.
Right. But when he was, you know, 19 or 20 when the show was getting going.
He was, well,
wasn't
okay.
he?
Well,
early 20s,
maybe when it was in workshop. It was the Tony winner for 2017. And he just this past weekend turned 28.
Okay.
So he was like 23, 24 by the time the Broadway run really
sure.
got going.
In any case, he had a boyish haircut.
Yes.
Like pretty run-of-the-mill, go to the barbershop, get that typical boy haircut.
Yeah.
You know, not too long, not too short. Comb, you know, parted on one side. Youthful, fresh. Well, now he's 28. Got this movie. And they've curled up his hair.
Yes.
Or maybe he has curly hair and we didn't know it. And the boyish haircut on stage was a little wig. I don't know. All I know is that now the hair is curly. And it is strange. Because It is by turns bigger and smaller throughout the film. And I wonder, you know, why this choice was made. If this was meant to make him look younger, it didn't do the trick.
It did not.
It could very well be that his hairline is receding.
Mm.
And it was meant to, you know, address that issue. But here's the thing. I want to go in on the whole age situation here for just a moment.
Okay.
When I was in high school, there were a good handful of guys that I knew who by 10th, 11th grade were beginning to have receding hairlines.
Right.
Okay.
Because they'd been shaving since 6th grade.
This is just something that happens to some young men. So you could say, you know, oh, you could even comment on it. You could say, yeah, I know. It sucks. I'm 17 and my hairline is receding.
Yeah.
This is not so rare that people would be shocked by it. Furthermore, I don't think he looks particularly old in this film. We accepted Gabrielle Carteris on 90210 playing a 17-year-old, and she was 28 at the time.
No,
we accepted Ian Ziering on the same show, and he was almost that old.
Stockard Channing was like 34 in Grease.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Yes, this is not unprecedented.
Watch Grease. Everyone in that movie is 35 years old.
Right.
And so the...
I think audiences are less forgiving about that sort of thing in general, and I think this one specifically is its own...
I will now tell you the story of the guy who sat in front of me in 8th grade. Every day at 3 o'clock, when school let out, that kid had a 5 o'clock shadow. We were 13. All right. He was a man. All right. And he didn't have, it wasn't just that he had, like, you know, full beard and chest hair spilling out of his t-shirt. Though he did.
And was 6'2".
And have like a boyish face. Uh-huh. He didn't even have the boyish face anymore.
Oh, I see.
You would look at him and go, are you actually an undercover cop?
He had a jaw and everything.
But no undercover cop would have been allowed to go into a school looking that way. They would have sent someone who looked like Leonardo DiCaprio.
Right.
So this kid was legit. And he was, again, 13 and a man. Already dating teachers, for all I know. Okay.
Go ahead.
So I do not have a problem with Ben Platt playing this character. What I do have a problem with, as we will discuss, is the direction of, I'm going to call him poor Mr. Platt. Because the direction does him no favors.
No.
The cinematography does him no favors.
Absolutely.
Nothing in this film is doing Ben Platt any favors other than Ben Platt trying to keep it going.
There are movies where I think we can be conditioned to accept that this is what teenagers look like.
Right.
You know, and go with it, whether it's Grease or whatever. And obviously you have movies like 16 Candles and Rushmore that really kind of turn that around and cast
right.
actual teens and
right.
little kids and, you know, the occasional, like, giant person who had the growth spurt or whatever.
Right.
But there's so much else going on with this movie that's wrong.
Exactly.
That it just exacerbates the
yes.
wrongness of him playing that age.
Yes.
And it's like the slump, you know, the
there
the,
are
the,
intentional actor tricks on display.
Yeah.
That you notice.
All the slouching, all the sort of, like, you know, the curvature of the spine that he's giving us.
Yeah.
Coupled with the fact that he is still giving a stage performance,
yes,
to a camera that is inches away from his face,
yes,
and that's, you know, go back and look at the movie of the musical The Producers, same
yes.
problem. In that case, they had actually hired the stage director to do the film, and she did not calibrate, you know, performances
right.
and other things to work in the cinematic medium. And Schabowski did not direct the stage show, but he did not, you know, I think there's this notion of like, oh, well, you know, Ben Platt created the role. He won a Tony. Like, we're just, he knows
what to do. Right.
And I think he's, what he's doing is for the back mezzanine, and it's disconcerting in a film.
So here's what the movie's about. Before seeing this film, I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go read the Wikipedia page for the stage show to figure out what the movie was about. I thought it was literally about a kid who broke his arm. And in some ways, it is about a kid who broke his arm and why he broke his arm.
Absolutely.
And what happens because he broke his arm.
Right.
But, all right, here's the story. Evan Hansen is a kid who deals with clinical depression and anxiety. Takes medication for it. Sees a therapist. The therapist tells him, you're going to write letters to yourself. You're going to write a letter to yourself. And it's going to, every day, I guess.
I think.
And it's going to say, Dear Evan Hansen, here's why today is going to be an okay day. You're going to do this and you're going to do this. Sort of like a way for him to self-guide, you know, around the cruelties of life and high school and the difficulty of, you know, a condition that you did not ask for. So he writes this letter to himself, has it on him at school. There's another kid at school who is clearly troubled in a way that expresses itself angrily and occasionally violently. And they have a run-in. And when they do, the other kid,
Connor,
takes the letter from Evan Hansen, signs his name to Evan Hansen's cast, runs off. The very next day, we learn that Connor has taken his own life. And on him, they have found the letter to Evan Hansen. They think that Connor wrote the letter to Evan Hansen. They think that Connor and Evan Hansen are friends, when in fact, Evan Hansen has one halvesies kind of friend. And
only because their moms are friends and
yeah,
they make him talk to him.
And has, up until that moment, has had no contact with Connor. A complicating factor is that Evan Hansen has a crush on Connor's younger sister. In this film, played by Caitlin Dever.
Dever.
Okay, we'll say Dever. Everyone immediately misunderstands the relationship that they think Evan Hansen had with Connor. He tries to explain, but the parents, the mom played by Amy Adams, the dad played by, I'm scrolling down now to get the name, Danny Pino. The parents don't want to hear it. They're desperately clinging to the hope that Connor had one friend. And when they lay that on Evan Hansen, he goes along with it. There are clearly mixed motives with Evan Hansen. Not only does he want to please a family that is being very solicitous toward him, but he also kind of wants to stay close to the younger sister.
Right.
He is a kid who is making all kinds of bad decisions and makes them in a way that he feels like he can't get out of. The lies begin to mount, lie on top of lie, until it's too late.
He winds up becoming an internet sensation for this eulogy that he has to give at a memorial service. There's a whole, like,
there's a whole Heathers-esque subplot about, you know, another student in class, played by Amanda Stenberg, who starts, you know, she's the, forgive the square pegs reference here, she's the Muffy Tepperman of the school, on every committee,
runs,
does everything,
runs the clubs,
runs all the clubs, she does it all. She's organizing a mental health group now in honor of Connor. She wants Evan Hansen involved in it. He's like, but no. And it doesn't matter because he, again, suddenly people are talking to him and he wants to be on this ride. He wants to be on the ride of people being nice to him and paying attention to him. And then it all blows up in his face.
Yes. As you know, it has to.
Yeah, well, there's no choice.
Yeah.
You know, you can't not have this. You cannot dig yourself this deep of a hole, or if you prefer, you cannot build yourself this shaky of a tower and not watch it fall down.
Right. Did you ever see World's Greatest Dad?
Which one is that?
The Bobcat Goldthwait movie with Robin Williams, where Robin Williams, his son is played by the kid from Spy Kids, and he's awful and obnoxious.
No, I didn't tell.
And he commits suicide under really hideous manners. But then Robin Williams, like, writes all this poetry and says that it was the son's, and becomes this sort of like celebrity based on how he's coping with the son's death. And it's and that movie commits to the darkness of this bit and how awful the thing that the person is doing is and what selfish motivation they have for doing it. The Bibbs made this connection on Twitter and I had not thought about it, but once he said it, I was like, oh my God, you're right. Because this movie, while it acknowledges that Evan is doing a terrible thing and that it's going to all blow up in his face, it lives in constant terror that we're going to stop liking him.
Yes.
And that we're, or that we're going to leave feeling bad about any of this.
Right.
And so at every turn, the movie cushions and sort of not rationalizes necessarily, but definitely softens every possible, you know, pointy edge that might exist between, you know, the action and the denouement. And it's kind of creepy, and it is hand in hand with how badly I think they are handling these important issues of mental health among teenagers, be they, you know, anxiety, depression, you know, all the way up to suicidal ideation.
I wouldn't use the word creepy, but I would use, you know, muddled and
unfocused,
mistaken, because you're right. It is a scenario in which, when everything does finally blow up, the way out is pretty easy.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that. Because that's, up to this point, you have a really bold idea for a story and a protagonist that you are meant to be, you're meant to feel empathy for, or at least sympathy. And I think quite often Ben Platt is the reason why you do feel, you know, like you want to protect this kid.
Mm-hmm.
His performance, as you said, is very big and it's very Broadway. But the anguish on his face throughout is, I think it's very effective. Also, these songs, which are from the Greatest Showman people, so it's not my kind of thing.
They're also the La La Land people.
Well, okay. That's also not exactly my kind of thing.
Oh, that's true. I forgot.
But you know what he can do really well?
Belt.
Ben Platt. He can sing it.
Yeah.
I honestly, up until this film, I've never heard him sing. I know that's kind of his thing. I've never heard him sing. And he's quite good at that. Selling me on songs that otherwise I'd be like, no.
The songs don't register with me at all. Like,
well, they're all very much of a type.
Yeah.
They're very contemporary musical.
The only one that stands out to me is the one that Amanda Stenberg does, which she co-wrote with those guys. It's one of the two new songs here.
Yeah.
And that one actually sort of felt, I don't know, less. The songs are very on the nose about what's happening right now and how I feel about it. And
is the song that Connor sings in Flashback
also
a
new one?
Is that a new one?
Yeah,
because it's a very funny song about a really horrible thing, and I didn't know if I was supposed to be laughing because the lyrics are quite like witty and funny in parts, and I. And I And the kid played by Colton Ryan, who plays Connor, is really sort of like selling it in an old-timey Busby Berkeley kind of way. And you think, is this appropriate right now?
Well, I think in another movie that had earned it by that point, you know, like the Julianne Moore gets a who plays Evan's mother, gets a really powerful 11 o'clock number here.
Probably the least accomplished singer in the movie, but who delivers the most, I think, moving song.
Agreed.
The most moving performance of a song in the film, because she's really acting this song in a way that feels right for the camera.
Exactly. Like I went back and got the original cast album of Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
And the guy who played Seymour on stage can sing in a Broadway way.
Yes.
And then you listen to Rick Moranis and it's like, well, it's not that you can't sing, but you're acting these songs in a way that you don't have to sing, because you're conveying all that stuff again to the camera and not to the Winter Palace or whatever.
And so I
think that she knows how to perform this in a filmic context, and so she winds up, I think, coming off the best of anybody here. I think if the movie had committed to the was it willing to let the audience be more uncomfortable about what is a very uncomfortable situation, then this would have been provocative and bold in some ways. But it's so eager to let you and Evan and everybody else off the hook that it's just a lot of nothing.
Let's go back to the direction.
Yes.
And the way that the camera is always up in Ben Platt's face. And Ben Platt, as you said, is swinging for the...
is giving face.
Swinging for the bleachers and serving an anguish face that is not the kind of thing you want to see for so long.
Yeah.
Right up in close-up, singing a song, half-crying while he's doing it, and...
Claire Danes does not cry for 2 hours solid in anything. You want a little of that, and then...
So I'm of so many mixed feelings here. This is not a good movie. It's a giant mess. But I feel like I want to give credit to performers where it's due, and I don't want to, like, dump all this on Ben Platt's head. Like, not that I can, because I'm just nobody, but perhaps someone else should have played this role.
Yeah.
I know his dad runs Universal.
Or is an executive
producer
on
this film.
Or
whatever. Yeah. And you know, that means you get what you want, I guess.
There is a
bad decision.
There is a history of the Broadway star not doing the movie. And you can argue whether or not that's a good thing. But I think, for example, that Carol Channing's singular talents translate better on the stage than they do to the screen. I think Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Funny Girl would have been very different movies. Not Funny Girl, sorry. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Hello Dolly would have been very different movies with her in them. In the case of Hello Dolly, it couldn't have hurt, I suppose, although, Streisand is fun in that movie. I think an actual, like, 16, 17-year-old kid with a singing voice playing Evan Hansen might have made this a different
experience. I think that you are forgetting the many great things that Carol Channing has done on movie screens.
Oh, look.
She was in The First Traveling Sales Lady, I'll have you know, in 1956, and she sang a song about corsets that is burned into my head.
True. And she has a romance with Clint Eastwood.
She certainly does in that film. It's a weird, not good movie that you need to watch.
Yes. Another weird, not good movie you should watch with her in it is Skidoo.
Well, Skidoo is weird, but it's not not good.
True.
It's weird and great.
It's epically something. and absolute, you like a movie, like, stop the podcast and watch it right now.
Look,
it's great.
Go hunt down every single thing that Carol Channing ever did and worship
now,
her.
Now, you still haven't seen Thoroughly Modern Millie.
That's correct,
so,
I have not.
So don't come to me. About not appreciating.
I just wanted to remind you.
That was her Oscar nomination.
I wanted to remind you about the corset song.
You're right.
A corset can do a lot for a lady.
Yes.
That's the name of the song.
That is an amazing song.
You know, it would be nice if mental health in the cinema were treated with intelligence and audacity, but
honesty,
care.
Yeah. Yes.
It's so carelessly handled all the time. And often well-meaning, you know? But just maybe it's a subject that's so difficult to get right that people should think twice before they make films about it. I don't know what the answer
is. Yeah, this movie, I think, wants to be saying something about, you know, the travails of young people, but yeah. it does so not well.
All right. What are we talking about? Everybody's talking about Jamie.
Yes.
That's the name of that one.
Now, if you're going to watch a High School Musical based on a stage production, this is the one to watch. This was based on a West End musical, which in turn was based on a documentary about a real teenager.
Real kid.
Yeah, real teenage drag queen and his supportive mom.
Yep.
So yeah, this is,
It's from Jonathan Butterell, mm-hmm. Dan Gillespie Sells, and Tom McRae, three directors in one film. I don't know how that works.
I think at least Butterell, maybe all three of them, were the stage directors.
Okay, well then I guess it works that way.
Yes.
It stars Max Harwood as a boy named Jamie. He goes to school, and he knows where he's going.
Indeed.
He's 16, and he has a clear direction in his head of what he wants to do, who he wants to be, where he wants to go. He is openly gay at school. He deals with the bullies brazenly and forthrightly, sometimes to the consternation of his teacher, played by Sharon Horgan. As you said, he has a wonderfully supportive mother, a father who sort of sometimes tries, but not always.
Barely. Sarah Lancashire plays the mother.
Yes. He has a best friend, played by Lauren Patel, and a drag mentor, played by Richard E. Grant.
Oh, man.
And that's the man you want to be your any kind of mentor.
I know right
in
now.
In any sort of life endeavor.
We're at a moment in cinema where we're talking about how, like, we need to have, you know, LGBT characters played by LGBT actors. But I gotta say, after Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yeah.
And everybody's talking about Jamie.
Richard E. Grant.
Richard E. Grant gets a pass.
Forever.
Yes.
He's an honorary gay.
He can play all the elder gays
we decided,
he wants.
Just here and now. Yes. He can play all the queer elders he needs to play.
Because dang.
Also, Max Harwood is queer and it's his like first film.
Yeah.
And he's a queer kid playing a queer role. Everyone's happy.
Yeah. Max Harwood is a star. Like,
I would say that, yeah.
For a kid who has never made a movie before, he owns this thing. He is so charismatic and dynamic and exciting to watch. And, you know, unlike Ben Platt, okay. Dear Evan Hansen, you know, understands how you go big, because half of this movie is him fantasizing about what his drag review
spectacular
is going to look
futures,
like.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and obviously, you know, drag queens are all about exaggeration and big. But he does it in a way that isn't discomforting. He captures the spirit of that sort of ebullience, that, you know, that opulence, if you will.
Now, this film is not going anywhere that you don't know.
No, it is very much the gifted high school kid on the verge of figuring out what his life is going to be and overcoming stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, he is openly gay, so it's not a coming out story in
Correct.
That sense.
Correct.
He does come out as a drag queen. Like, right. That's sort of his next step on the evolutionary ladder. But the gay part is like, we can take that as read.
Is drag queen the next step on everyone's evolutionary ladder?
I like to think so.
It should be.
It is definitely an elevated state.
As I was saying, the film itself is not giving you anything new in the form of the film musical or in the teen, you know, I have a dream and I'm going to triumph story. But it is very competently packaged. It looks good. The musical numbers are fun. They are staged in a way that doesn't cut everybody off at the knees. And at least one of these songs is really moving.
The Richard E. Grant number in which he basically tells the story of his life, and the song is sung by
Holly Johnson.
Yes, Frankie Goes to Hollywood. But it is this sort of
Richard E. Grant is lip syncing to Holly Johnson.
Okay. But it's this sort of flashback to his youth as a drag queen coming up during Margaret Thatcher, during AIDS, all this stuff.
Yeah.
The late 80s, early 90s. And the film very seamlessly sort of like gives you these flashbacks and lets Richard E. Grant and Max Harcourt sort of stand in the background, even when it's like TV news footage somehow, like they're there as well.
Yeah, they're very skillfully FX'd into shots.
Yeah. So for a film that's made by for a film musical that's directed by the person who's never made a movie before who directed the stage musical, there is a lot of cinema language happening here that you might not expect. But the number itself, between Holly Johnson's performance of the song and the song itself, and just the visuals that we get of what this character has endured and the loved ones that he lost, I had to stop the movie. I had to stop and just sit on the sofa.
I know you did.
And cry for a while, because it was one of the most gutting things I've seen in a movie this year.
Yeah.
So you can dismiss the rest of this film if you want and just say that it's like feel good, you know.
It is feel good.
High school treacle, whatever.
It is feel good fluff. But that is exactly what it is.
That number knocked me down.
Sometimes feel good fluff is done very well.
Yeah.
And you end up realizing the world needs a little bit of feel-good fluff sometimes.
Yeah. But it's feel-good fluff with a moment that will punch you in the stomach.
Yeah. Particularly if you are a queer person of a certain age.
Yes.
And that's what we are.
We are indeed.
We were in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
We were there when Frankie Goes to Hollywood was hot on the charts.
That's right. I listened to that cassette over and over again in my freshman dorm room. So anyway, Everybody's Talking About Jamie is on Amazon Prime. You can see it there. Evan Hansen, only in theaters. Starling on Netflix.
All right, so we are going to talk about I Carry You With Me.
Yes.
Now, if you recall, Alonzo talked about it already several months ago.
Yes, when it was in theaters.
When it was in theaters only, and I didn't get a chance to see it. And so it is now available to stream. And I watched it. And what we said we were going to do was talk about it and then talk about the ending. Because you were keen to talk about the ending. Although the ending is a big surprise. Like the final 20 minutes of this film are a great big gear shift surprise. Not in a gimmicky way, in an incredibly moving way. So, here's what we're going to do. We're going to read letters.
Yes.
We're going to say goodbye.
And then we're going to talk about
it. And then we're going to... So, when I say goodbye, like I always do at the end of every podcast, if you don't want to know all the stuff about I Carry You With Me, then make that your goodbye.
Yes.
If you do want to know, regardless of whether you've seen it already or not, stick around. Because the last review is going to be after I say goodbye.
And incidentally, it is streaming. It's also on DVD and Blu-ray now, too.
Yeah. Okay, so, letters. Daniel says, regarding Cry Macho, I was sure that based on the title that this was supposed to be a comedy. You would be wrong.
Yeah, it either sounds like a comedy or it sounds like a fake movie in another movie. But no, it's real.
Jennifer has a two-part letter. Hi, guys. Just a note to say that I once had the pleasure of corresponding with Tammy Faye about poodles, which she and I both loved. She was extremely sweet, and I liked her. I wish I had advice for Dave about his new blood sugar equipment, but alas, I do not. Finally, I consider you two relationship goals.
No.
Sometimes I wonder if same-sex couples are more compatible than opposite-sex marriages. I could tell you something right now, Jennifer. We know a whole lot of queer couples. And some of them are real messy.
Fractious,
one might say. And they get, and now that it's legal to be married since 2015, oh, the divorces.
I was going to say, it's also legal to get divorced. And they do.
I'll keep reading. Personally, I keep waiting to join the other team, but at my age, I know it's not going to happen. I'm trying to accept this situation.
Hey, Elvira was married to a man for like 20-something years.
And that's true.
You know.
Then she leveled up.
Exactly.
She says, P.S., I found the last copy of Lair, the movie villain.
Oh, cool.
You on did Amazon. An LKRX, she said, so. I can't wait. Thanks. And then part two. Guys, I forgot to add the part about what is up with Christian women and puppets. Do they think that puppets get through to children and are less creepy than a human being? If so, they are wrong. Then she downloads. She sends me some JPEGs to download of manger babies from King of the Hill.
Yes.
And do you remember Marcy?
Marcy?
The Christian puppet lady, Marcy?
I never had the pleasure.
Well, I'll let you see all about it after.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Jennifer.
Yes.
For the letter. Those are the letters.
That's it.
All of them.
Okay. So now I'm doing my
wrap it up
spiel. Okay, great. Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. You can subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts. If you leave us a 5-star review, we will read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, thelounge.com, Spotify, Pandora, Google Play, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean, and more. You can follow us on the social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. You know what? I just remembered we had another letter, but we'll get to it next time.
Okay.
I remember the header was not a pity letter because last episode we didn't have any letters at all. We'll get to that one. Sorry, I left it off. All right. Until next time.
Don't forget, after I say goodbye, we're going to talk about I Carry You With Me.
We will.
Everybody ready? Goodbye.
Bump.
Bump. Bump. And now it's time to talk about I Carry You With Me. Briefly, I'll explain what the movie is.
Yeah.
Heidi Ewing, who made Jesus Camp.
Mm-hmm.
She's a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
She has taken on a narrative project. It is the story of a man named Ivan and a man named Gerardo. Ivan is played by Armando Espedia, and Gerardo is played by Christian Vasquez. They are young men in the 90s in Mexico. And Ivan is a chef, or he wants to be. He's been to culinary school, but he can't find work as even a prep cook, not even a line cook, not even a sous chef. He can't get work doing what he wants to do. He has a little son. Little six-year-old kid. He has an ex who is pretty stingy with the visitation with the six-year-old kid. And you come to understand why in just a moment. Ivan is gay. And he meets Gerardo in a gay bar. They hit it off. They become very close. They fall in love. And then they are caught by the ex.
Yeah.
And when she catches them, she says, I knew it. So she had sort of suspected this all along. And that's, you know, you're married to someone with a secret. You start to look for that secret, you know. She says to Ivan, you are never seeing your son again. with nothing to keep him there, he decides to cross the border into the U.S., trying to find work as a chef. He does this out of a sense of, you know, his own need, but also because he knows that if he can make it doing that there, he will be able to support his son.
Right.
In ways that he has not been able to do in Mexico. So he goes. And before he goes, he says to Gerardo, forget about me. You're not coming with me. This what I'm about to do is not for you. Forget about me.
Because there's also like, it's been a while since I've seen this. There's like a class difference between the two of them, right? Doesn't
yes.
Gerardo come from like
yes.
gentry?
Gerardo comes from some
landowners.
From some money. They've got a cattle ranch. And, yeah.
Yeah.
So Ivan goes to the United States and he struggles and struggles and struggles for years as a, you know, he works in construction. He works as a delivery guy. One day when there's an actual brawl in the kitchen where he's working and a cook is fired, he walks up to the owner chef and says, I can help. I've been to cooking school. I can help. And the owner's like, you're the delivery guy. And he says, I can help. And he puts him on the line. And he works his way up. He's a line cook for a long time. And then he's a chef. In the meantime, Gerardo has followed him to New York, where they are both living. They become a couple again. They stay a couple. They live together in New York. Ivan misses his son, but he knows that he cannot go back to Mexico and then return to the U.S. because it's even harder for undocumented people in the U.S. now than it was when he came over.
Right.
So with about 20 minutes to go in this film, it shifts gears and becomes a documentary.
The film opens with a guy riding the subway heading into work, you know, dressed in, you know, he's got like restaurant, you know, chef pants, that kind of thing. And then it goes into a flashback. And you think, oh, okay, well, so this is the
actor. That's an actor playing the older
character. And then you get to the end of the film, you find out, oh, no.
That's the guy.
That's actual Ivan.
That's real Ivan. This is a true story. Ivan and Gerardo are real people. And the final sequence of this film, the third act, the last 20, 25 minutes,
is about them.
Is a documentary about Ivan and Gerardo.
Yeah.
And the now 20-year-old son who is trying to see his father.
Yeah. Did not see that coming.
Did not see that coming. And it is so skillfully handled.
Yeah.
Without fanfare. Just very, like, seamlessly shifting gears into, oh, by the way, here are the real people.
Yeah. This whole thing you've been watching is a true story.
Ivan now is a chef who owns his own restaurant. He's working with an immigration lawyer.
Yeah.
And realizes that in spite of the fact that he is a job-creating entity
yes.
in New York mm-hmm. and if he left the country, people would lose their jobs and a business would close down. The immigration lawyer, the real-life immigration lawyer, says to him, I'm sorry, there's nothing that you can do.
Yeah.
There is no path that you can take that will make this work out. You have to stay put and hope that you are not deported.
Yeah. If you are interested, after you see the movie, which you absolutely should, hunt down, Carlos Aguilar has written quite a bit about this film. He is a critic who works with me at The Wrap. He is himself
undocumented yeah.
and cannot return to Mexico
right.
lest he never get back to the United States. And so obviously this film resonates with him a great deal, and he has interviewed everybody and written a lot about it, and it adds a lot more insight to...
Every time some new bizarre, cruel immigration thing comes along in the U.S., which is routine
yes.
now, when I see his Twitter, he's like, I'm really freaked out. I'm really freaked out right now. And you think, oh my God. Like,
this would also be a really good double feature with Lingua Franca.
Yeah. Well, there are other films that that are, you know, antecedents of this one. There's a wonderful film from early 2020 that we talked about called I'm No Longer Here.
Right, yes.
Ya no estoy aquí. Is the weird thing about the way that one has been received in the world is that it seems to go by both the English and the Spanish title simultaneously or alternately. And so it helps me to forget what it's called in both languages most of the time. But it is an incredible film about a young kid who unwillingly winds up in
going
the U.S.
to New York,
to escape violence happening in his small, you know, community in Mexico. But yeah, it's called I'm No Longer Here, and it's on Netflix.
Yes.
So if you got Netflix, you can watch it, and it's really great.
It is.
Jim Sheridan?
In America?
Oh, wait, no. I got the name wrong. Pause. Jim McKay.
Ah.
Jim McKay, who directed Our Song,
yes,
had a film in 2017 called En el Séptimo Día, on the seventh day. Again, about a young man from Mexico who is undocumented and who lives in New York, works in a restaurant.
Well, Jim Sheridan also did In America, which is also about undocumented immigrants, although from Ireland.
Yeah. And you go all the way back to Gregory Nava's El Norte. Yeah. Films about undocumented people in the United States. And the absolute cruelty of U.S. immigration policy. And that goes all the way back, but decades.
No matter what party is in power.
No matter who's in power, it sucks. There were a record number of deportations under Obama.
Yes.
There were, like, nasty, horrific things that took place under Trump. And the Biden administration is continuing a lot of this stuff.
Yes.
So it seemingly doesn't matter who you're voting for anymore. Even if you are voting for a candidate who promises to do nice things for immigrants like Biden had, they're lying to you.
Yeah.
And the worst part about this, I have very personal experience with this because I was an ESL teacher for 8 years in Texas, and all of my kids, all of my students were immigrants. And I will tell you something. Immigrants make the United States better. Hands down, all the time. Do some of them make crime happen? I suppose percentage-wise, as many as per capita as non-immigrants, right? But on the whole, in general, and the only reason I even say this as a qualifying thing is because I have someone that I know who's been posting a lot of anti-immigrant stuff lately on social media, and it's enraging.
And undocumented immigrants are also paying
it's
a
all
lot
about,
of...
It's all about how, you know, this crime happened and that crime happened.
Oh, of course.
And I'm like, you know what? Shut up!
Yes, they're cherry-picking. They pay a lot of taxes, and very often for programs that they then don't get access to because they're undocumented.
Anyway, this whole... Listen, I get riled up
about
this.
Don't get us started.
There's a line in this film where, close to the end, where he says, I feel like I'm trapped in a cage. And because this is a queer relationship, the story becomes one of, you know, where do you want to live in hiding? You want to live in hiding in a country that hates you for your sexuality? Do you want to live in a country that hates you for your sexuality and your nationality? What's the better deal? And there's not a good answer.
No.
This is an incredibly moving, like, take your breath away, heartbreaking film.
Yes. I'm so glad you saw it.
Highly recommend.
Yes.
Like, high recommendation. I Carry You With Me is the name of the movie.
Rent it, buy it, check it out.
Yeah.
All right. Now that we've spoiled it, But we haven't spoiled it. You'll still, even if you haven't watched it yet, you'll still dig it, even if though you know the things that you know. Until next time.
Again, goodbye.
Goodbye.